chapter 38, and starting at verse 39, which in the church Bibles is on page 533. And this passage is where God reveals his greatness as he questions Job about wild animals. Can you hunt the prey for the lion or satisfy the appetite of the young lions when they crouch in their dens or lie wait in their thicket? Who provides for the raven its prey when its young ones cry to God for help and wander for the lack of food? Do you know when the mountain goats give birth? Do you observe the calving of the does? Can you number the months that they fulfill? And do you know the time they give birth, when they crouch, bring forth their offspring, and are delivered of their young? Their young ones become strong. They grow up in the open. They go out and do not return to them. Who has let the wild donkey go free? Who has loosed the bonds of the swift donkey, to whom I have given the arid plain for his home and the salt land for his dwelling place? He scorns the tumult of the city. He hears not the shouts of the driver. He ranges the mountains as his pasture and searches after every green thing. Is the wild ox willing to serve you? Will he spend the night at your manger? Will you bind him in the furrow with ropes, or will he harrow the valleys after you? Will you depend on him because of his strength? And will you leave to him your labour? Do you have faith in him that he will return your grain and gather it to your threshing floor?
So we're continuing our reading on page 533. So this is the second half of the reading. So Job chapter 39, verse 13. So God speaking to Job says, "The wings of the ostrich wave proudly, but are they the pinions and plumage of love? For she leaves her eggs to the earth and lets them be warmed on the ground, forgetting that a foot may crush them and that the wild beast may trample them. She deals cruelly with her young, as if they were not hers. Though her labor be in vain, yet she has no fear, because God has made her forget wisdom and given her no share in understanding. When she rises herself to flee, she laughs at the horse and his rider. Do you give the horse his might? Do you clothe his neck with a mane? Do you make him leap like the locust? His majestic snorting is terrifying. He paws in the valley and exults in his strength. He goes out to meet the weapons. He laughs at fear and is not dismayed. He doesn't turn back from the sword. Upon him rattle the quiver, the flashing spear, and the javelin. With fierceness and rage, he swallows the ground. He cannot stand still at the sound of the trumpet. When the trumpet sounds, he says, 'Aha!' He smells the battle from afar, the thunder of the captains and the shouting. Is it by your understanding that the hawk soars and spreads his wings towards the south? Is it at your command that the eagle mounts up and makes his nest on high? On the rock he dwells and makes his home, on the rocky crag and stronghold. From there he spies out the prey, his eyes behold it afar off. His young ones suck up blood, and where the slain are, there is he." And the Lord said to Job, "Shall a fault finder contend with the Almighty? He who argues with God, let him answer it." Then Job answered the Lord and said, "Behold, I am of small account. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand on my mouth. I've spoken once, and I will not answer twice, but I will proceed no further." Well, please do keep that open, and then inside your service sheets is an outline of where we're going in the next few minutes. And just a reminder, if any of the young ones get restless, the back room, you can hear us, we can't hear you. I wonder what your favourite animal is. This planet is home to 8.7 million species of living things, the vast majority of which are animals. The animal kingdom is staggeringly varied and stunningly beautiful. You've got giraffes, You've got zebras, you've got butterflies, you've got gorillas, you've got hummingbirds, you've got dolphins and so on. And you watch these, you know, the David Attenborough documentaries, you watch these things and you wonder, how can this guy study the natural world so closely and yet not see a good creator God behind it all? You know, how could this all possibly have come about by chance? There's so much unnecessary beauty, as if God just couldn't help himself. You know, like a master artist having fun. You know, they're going to love these peacock feathers kind of thing. And such clear evidence of design as well. How does a woodpecker avoid brain injury? I mean, they slam their beak against the trunk of a tree 20 times a second, and yet they suffer no ill effects. In contact sports, a person gets concussion with an impact of 80 times the force of gravity. 80. The impact on the woodpecker is 1,200 times that of gravity. But it's fine because of the way that its skull is designed. God creates the animals. He cares and provides for them. Here in Job 39, God takes Job and he takes us on a tour of the animal kingdom. But he doesn't take us around Mudsheep Farm. He takes us out into the wild. Yeah, he takes us on safari. Because the animal kingdom, it's not just beautiful and designed. It's also wild. And it's strange. And it's brutal. And yet God made it. And he sustains it. And there are lessons that we need to learn from this. Because you remember that because of his suffering, Job had been questioning God. He'd been questioning how God was running the world, how he was running his life. And Job thought he knew better than God. Job thought he could do a better job than God. And God is now showing Job, and he's showing us how ridiculous it is to think like that. Job was totally out of his depth. And God began to expose that in chapter 38. With this barrage of questions we looked at last week to him about the non-living natural world. And he exposed how little Job actually knows compared to God. He now moves on in chapter 39 to the living natural world, so the animal kingdom. Like Job, we may be struggling with questions at the moment about, you know, what is God doing in my life? What's God doing in the world? To get things in perspective, God invites us to join him on safari. He invites us to take a walk with him on the wild side. The first animals we encounter, and I'll put some picture on the screen if you're struggling to picture what some of these animals are. The first animals we encounter are lions and ravens. So have a look with me at 38, verse 39. God says to Job, "Can you hunt the prey for the lion or satisfy the appetite of the young lions when they crouch in their dens and lie in wait in their thicket?" Implied answer, no, you can't, but I do. Now, lions, it's going to be annoying this hooting, isn't it? Anyway, lions are predators. Lions kill and eat other animals for food. God has made them that way. And not only that, God tells us here that he actually hunts the prey for them. Do you see it says that? And that involves the death of another animal. But God is hunting for them. Have you seen, maybe on these TV documentaries, have you seen a lion hunting and killing a deer? I mean, it's brutal, isn't it? But the young lions need feeding, and so God provides the meal. Same with the ravens, verse 41. Who provides for the raven its prey when its young ones cry to God for help and wander about for lack of food? Answer, well, God does. So the young ravens cry to God for help and he answers them at the cost of the life of another animal. This is life in the wild. Predators kill for food or they starve. And this is telling us that God is actively involved in that process. He doesn't just leave it to them. And we may find that a bit disturbing. The poet Tennyson wrote in one of his poems, he wrote that nature is red in tooth and claw. And he said that seems to scream against the Bible's teaching that God is love. He wrote, "Are God and nature then at strife? That is, are they in conflict? How do we reconcile the brutality of nature with a God of love?" Were lions hunting prey before the fall? So was that part of the original good creation? Genesis 1, chapter 30 seems to imply that animals and humans were vegetarian before the fall. But if so, did God only create predators after the fall? Or did he create them before the fall with teeth and claws, but which they didn't actually use before the fall to kill? We don't know. We don't know for sure. But what we do know for sure is that God made predators and he provides them with their prey. And that is part of his wise governing of the world. And it's got spiritual lessons to teach us. For lions, for ravens to live, other animals suffer and they die. And it's brutal. But it points us to a higher reality. Ultimately, the brutal suffering and death of an innocent man, Jesus Christ, would bring life to many. And this principle of life from death that we see in the animal kingdom is actually hardwired into the plant kingdom as well, isn't it? So as Jesus said in John 12:24, he said about a grain of wheat, if it dies, it bears much fruit. And Jesus applied this as well to the life of the disciple, that only in dying to our sinful selves, can we bear much fruit and bring life to other people. And even the physical death of a believer, it may be the means of bringing life to somebody else. The witness of a loved one suffering and dying from cancer. It could be something that God uses in his wisdom to bring eternal life to someone else. And in the wider human world, there is so much predator and prey behavior. But this is telling us that God is sovereign over this wild world. And although God is not the author of evil, he is working out his purposes through it all. So when we look at the world, when we look at our lives, and we see so much suffering and death, and we're tempted to conclude, God must have lost the plot. God says, take a look at the lions, take a look at the ravens. The all-wise sovereign God, he knows what he's doing, even if to us it seems strange. Secondly, God introduces us to mountain goats. There's a mountain goat on the screen, if you're wondering, to teach us about timing. So, 39:1, do you know when the mountain goats give birth? Answer, no, but God does. We don't see mountain goats giving birth, but God does, and he oversees the whole process. He knows all the times involved. So verse 1, he says, do you observe the calving of the does? Can you number the months that they fulfill? Do you know the time when they give birth, when they crouch, bring forth their offspring, and are delivered of their young? And then the young ones grow up and leave. Verse 4, their young ones become strong. They grow up in the open. They go out and don't return to them. Like Job, we have not got a clue about the life cycle of a mountain goat. But God does. God follows it all very closely. He sees it all the stages of waiting and birth and growth. If God is that involved in the life of mountain goats, do you think he might be involved in your life too, in my life? Even more so? And the timing of the circumstances of our lives as well? In his suffering, Job was struggling with time. In earlier chapters, he talked about wishing he hadn't been born and experiencing months of emptiness and nights of misery and longing for death. But the mountain goats teach him and they teach us that the timing of our lives are in his hands. When we're born, when we die, and the times in between those two points, including the times of waiting when we wonder what God is up to. You ever sat in a waiting room for an appointment and time drags, and after a while you wonder, have I actually dropped off the system here or something? You know, names are called, but it's never your name. And, you know, sometimes it turns out you have dropped off the system. And in times of waiting, we can wonder, have I dropped off God's system? Has he forgotten about me? Waiting for marriage. Waiting for a child. Waiting for healing. Waiting for a change in our situation at work or situation at home. Waiting for a difficult season in our lives to end. And nothing happens. And we start to wonder, has God forgotten about me? But if he's watching over the mountain goats, we can be pretty sure he's watching over us as well. Just as he hadn't forgotten the people of Israel, who waited for hundreds of years in Egypt. And he didn't forget his promise to send the Christ, but he did so in the fullness of time, as he will with his return, for which we wait. God's third animal is the wild donkey. There we go on the screen. Verse 5. Who has let the wild donkey go free? Answer, God has. So God has made the wild donkey free to go wherever it wants. It says, who has loosed the bonds of the swift donkey? To whom have I given the arid plain for his home and the salt land for his dwelling place? So God's saying that he has given the wild donkey the dry salt flats for its home. He scorns the tumult of the city, verse 7. He hears not the shouts of the driver. So it's saying, you know, the wild donkey has a very different life to the urban donkey. Urban donkey pulling a cart in the city with his driver shouting at him. Verse 8, he ranges the mountains as his pasture and he searches after every green thing. If you saw a wild donkey all on its own, wandering through the salt plains looking for food, you might think, what a pointless life, yeah? What a pointless life, and nobody seems to care at all. But God does. God has given the donkey this freedom. He's given it this place to live. It's part of his sovereign plan and his ordering of the world. And maybe Job in his suffering could relate to the wild donkey. On his own, in a spiritually dry place, wandering, searching. But if God cared for the wild donkey, how much more so for him? His situation was under God's sovereign control and care. And so too for us, that when we find ourselves in similar situations, times of loneliness, times of spiritual dryness, times of wandering, searching, God is sovereign over all of this, just as he was over Israel's 40 years in the desert, Moses 40 years in exile, Jesus' 40 days in the wilderness. He knows what he's doing. We can trust him. Animal 4, the wild ox. God asks Job, verse 9, is the wild ox willing to serve you? Implied answer, no, but it does serve me. The wild ox was a terrifying, hugely powerful beast. And we use the expression, don't we? Strong as an ox. Untamable. So verse 9, God says, will he spend the night at your manger? Kind of joking, say, you've got to be kidding. No, of course not. Verse 10, can you bind him in the furrow with ropes, or will he harrow, that is, will he plough the valleys after you? Well, basically, no. You wouldn't stand a chance of getting a wild ox to plough your field. Verse 11, will you depend on him because his strength is great, and will you leave to him your labor? Implied answer, no way. You know, a wild ox won't use his strength to serve you. Verse 12, do you have faith in him that he will return your grain and gather it to your threshing floor? It's not going to happen. And again, God is putting Job in his place. He's showing the gulf that there is between God and him. Job does not have the power to tame a wild ox, but God does. It's way beyond Job's control, but not God's. The wild ox serves God. And so with wicked, powerful people in the world. Job had suffered at the hands of some of them, the armed raiders who brought death and destruction in chapter 1. But ultimately, these wild oxen, if we can call them that, they are, under God's sovereign control. In Psalm 22, David is being threatened by powerful, wicked people, and he pictures them as wild animals. In 22 verse 12, he says, "Strong bulls surround me." In verse 16 of Psalm 22, he says, "Dogs encompass me." And in verse 21 of that psalm, he calls them lions and wild oxen. But God was stronger than them, and he delivered them. Now, you may be aware that psalm foreshadows the sufferings of Jesus, the Christ. That Jesus was attacked by such wild oxen, but God delivered him. And God actually used their wickedness for his purposes. So Peter says in Acts 4:23, he says to the crowd, "You crucified and killed Jesus by the hands of lawless men, but this was according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God." There are plenty of wild oxen in the world today. That is to say, wicked, powerful people doing wicked things. And they are accountable for their evil, and God will judge them. But ultimately, God is sovereign, and he can use their wickedness to serve his purposes. So the wild ox is way beyond our control, but not way beyond God's. And sometimes God demonstrates his sovereign power by taking one of these wild oxen and taming them. He did that, didn't he, with a demon-possessed man in Mark chapter 4, that violent guy, and he does so through the gospel today as well. And so if you happen to have a wild ox on your team at work or living next door to you, don't give up. The safari tour takes us next from the terror of the ox to the folly of the ostrich. That's an ostrich on the screen, if you're wondering. Now, verse 13 says, "The wings of the ostrich wave proudly, but are they the pinions," that's the wings and plumage, "of love?" It doesn't appear so. For, it goes on, "she leaves her eggs to the earth and lets them be warmed on the ground, forgetting that a foot may crush them and that the wild beast may trample them. She deals cruelly with her young, as if they weren't hers. Though her labor be in vain, yet she has no fear." So he's saying the ostrich is not very clever. Ostriches lay their eggs on the ground where they can get stepped on and crushed, and then it would all be for nothing. But the ostrich doesn't seem to care. But why are ostriches like this? Well, what does verse 17 say? "Because God has made her forget wisdom and given her no share in understanding." God has made them that way. So it's not a very wise bird, but it has one special talent. What's the special talent in verse 18? "When she rouses herself to flee, she laughs at the horse and his rider." That's to say, God hasn't made the ostrich clever, but boy, he's made her quick. She can't fly, but she can outrun a horse and rider. I mean, look it up online. Ostriches are the fastest running birds around. They've been clocked sprinting at 40 miles per hour. So if you stick an ostrich in the marathon, it's going to be, podium position. So in the ostrich, God has made a creature which is foolish, but fast. Why? Why would God make a creature like this? I mean, it seems such a paradox, doesn't it? You've got a bird with wings, but that can't fly. You've got a bird that seems foolish, but can outrun a horse. Why? Well, to teach us a lesson. To tell us something about the world God has made. And the lesson seems to be this: don't dismiss what appears to be strange and foolish. For example, the gospel. The gospel message seems foolish. A man crucified in weakness is how God powerfully saves people. Seems crazy. But 1 Corinthians 1:21 says, "In the wisdom of God, it pleased God through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe." Many Christians seem foolish. But 1 Corinthians 1:27, God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. You may be a Christian who's been having doubts, or you may be a non-Christian looking in from the outside, and you look at the gospel message, you look at the church and the people there, and you think, surely this can't be the winning team. Surely not. This can't be the winning side. But this is saying, don't dismiss what appears to be foolish. This is God at work. This is the ostrich factor. So also with the circumstances of our lives. To us, to Job, it may seem foolish to think that God is at work in the circumstances of our lives, in our suffering, in our loss, in our disappointments, in our heartache. But God knows what he's doing. It's the ostrich factor. And don't dismiss people who seem foolish. God does not have a sort of cookie-cutter approach to creating people. There is huge variety of people, as in the animal kingdom. And he creates some people hyper-intelligent and others less so. But he gives them other gifts. It's the ostrich factor. Our next stop is the horse. When we hear horse, we think little pony in the paddock, or, you know, we think civilized show jumping. But the horse was the nuclear weapon of the ancient world. A horse with an armed rider coming at you in battle was terrifying. Have a look at verse 19. Do you give the horse his might? Answer, no, but I do, God says. Verse 19, do you clothe his neck with a mane? Do you make him leap like the locust? His majestic snorting is terrifying. He pours in the valley, exults in his strength. He goes out to meet the weapons. He laughs at fear and is not dismayed. He doesn't turn back from the sword. So imagine this war horse in battle. Upon him rattle the quiver for the arrows, the flashing spear, the javelin. With fierceness and rage, he swallows the ground. He can't stand still at the sound of the trumpet. When the trumpet sounds, he says, aha, he smells the battle from afar, the thunder of the captains and the shouting. So the horse is this hugely powerful creature who loves a fight, who gets excited by the smell and the sound of battle. It's made that way. But why? Why would God create a creature so perfectly suited for battle? Well, to teach us a lesson. To teach us that even war has its place in God's world, and is under his sovereign control. Now, some wars are just, and some are not. Job had been on the sharp end, hadn't he, of unjust raiders, who may well have been on war horses. But God is sovereign over the mighty horse. And Jesus entering Jerusalem on a donkey, that is not the full story. The final book of the Bible, Revelation, it pictures Jesus coming back one day, not on a donkey, but on a war horse. The divine warrior, leading the armies of heaven to make war on his enemies and to bring justice. That's Revelation 19. And so if our God, the God in whom we believe, if he's just the God of the pony in the paddock, that's not the true God. It's not the real world either. The real world has wars and it has war horses. And God is sovereign over it all, and he will bring justice. Well, the safari tour ends where it began, with predators and prey, and now with birds of prey. So verse 26. Is it by your understanding that the hawk soars and spreads his wings towards the south? Answer, no, but it is by mine. Is it at your command that the eagle mounts up and makes his nest on high? Answer, no, that it is by mine. On the rock he dwells and makes his home, on the rocky crag and stronghold. Okay, so far so good. But now it gets brutal. From there, verse 29, from there he spies out the prey, his eyes behold it from afar, his young ones suck up blood, and where the slain are, there he is. This is from God. When hawks and eagles go in for the kill to give their youngsters a bloody meal, they're not going rogue. They're using the understanding God has given them. They're operating by God's command. God made them this way. Why? Well, to teach us a spiritual lesson. That God is sovereign even over the brutality that we see in the world. He's not the author of evil, but he's sovereign over everything. He's working out his purposes through it. The sufferings of Christ are the ultimate example of this. Acts 4:27. The believers say to God, "In this city there were gathered together against your holy servant Jesus, both Herod and Pontius Pilate, along with the Gentiles and the people of Israel." And they're a bit like the birds of prey gathering together to attack. But it goes on, "to do whatever your hand and your plan had predestined to take place." So God was sovereignly at work even through their evil acts. Jesus said to Pilate, didn't he, in John 19:11, he said, "You would have no authority over me at all unless it had been given to you from above." That is from God. Verse 30 here is pretty gruesome in detail, isn't it? "His young ones suck up blood." And we think, how could that be God's doing? But God's salvation plan would involve a lot of blood, wouldn't it? The blood of an innocent man shed for us to give life to others, to give life to the many. And so we are like, we're the hungry eaglets, aren't we? As believers. As Jesus said in John 6:54, he said, "Whoever feeds on my flesh and drinks my blood has eternal life." We're the hungry eaglets getting fed. And as our catechism said today, only the blood of Christ can cleanse us from sin. So God is the God of the hawk and the eagle, and we need to hang on to that in a brutal world. And with that, God's safari tour comes to an end. Louis Armstrong famously sang, "What a beautiful world." And it is a beautiful world, but it's also a strange, wild world, as we see in the animal kingdom, but God is sovereign over it. On Christian calendars, you know, the sort of Christian picture calendars you can get where there's a different photo for each month, you tend to get beautiful photos, don't you, of sunsets and mountains and cute puppies and bunny rabbits and ponies and so on. God's calendar here has rather different pictures. A lion about to take down a gazelle. A war horse going into battle. An eagle with blood on its beak and claws. An ostrich at full speed. We're going to produce our own barge calendar, guys, so I hope you're going to buy it. This is the real world. This is Job's world. This is our world. It is a wild world, which to us contains so much which is strange, so much that is puzzling, but it's a world over which the all-powerful Creator God is sovereign. It's a world in which God knows what he is doing, and he calls us to humbly trust him. Not to question him, not to put him in the dock, not to think, "I could do a better job than you," as Job had foolishly thought. And having concluded his breathtaking tour of the natural world, the Lord says to Job in 40 verse 1, he says, "Shall a fault finder contend with the Almighty? He who argues with God, let him answer it." Job had been finding fault with God. He'd been arguing with him. He'd thought that God was in the wrong and that he, Job, was in the right. But taking on the Almighty is not for Job to do, and it is not for us to do. We need to know our place. God is the Almighty Maker and ruler of everything, and we are very small. So whenever we're tempted to question God and his ways because of maybe suffering in our lives or suffering in the world, we've got a bit too big for our boots. And we need to book ourselves a place on God's nature tour, and we need to listen to his questions. Because it puts us in our place, doesn't it? It sort of cuts us down to size. It makes us realize how absurd it is to think that we could know better than the Almighty. What size are we? What size are you? Verse 3, "Then Job answered the Lord and said, 'Behold, I'm a small account. And what shall I answer you? I lay my hand on my mouth. I've spoken once, I won't answer twice, but I'll proceed no further.'" God, as we saw last week, God has basically been saying, "Job, my friend, shut up. You don't know what you're talking about." And Job is now saying, "Yeah, I think that would be best if I did shut up. And that is a good step in the right direction. But God isn't finished with him yet. He's got another two chapters of questions for him and for us. Two more animals, two monsters. We'll look at those another time. But for now, let's just pause and let's make Job's response our own to God.